the nations understand more clearly their interests, their self-worth, uniqueness, and identity. They're ever more insistent in achieving their goals of development and justice. At the same time, societies are coming across a greater number of new challenges, from breathtaking technological breakthroughs to devastating natural catastrophes, from outrageous social inequity to massive waves of migration and most acute economic crises. Experts are talking about the threats of new regional conflicts and global epidemics, about complex and ambiguous ethical aspects of interaction between the human and the artificial intelligence, on the way traditions and progress combine with each other. Some of these issues we used to forecast during our meetings and discussed in detail in the Valdai Club. And some of the issues, well, we have intuitive presentiments about them, hoping for the best, but not ruling out the worst-case scenario. Some things became a complete surprise for everyone because the current world is so unpredictable and dynamically changing. If we take a look back 20 years ago and look at the scale of changes and project the scale in the future, we can assume that the next 20 years will be rather more complex. But how much more will depend naturally on a number of factors. And in order to analyze them and try to forecast something, I believe that's the reason why you gather here at the Valdai Club. To a certain extent, the moment of truth is coming. The previous world order is irreversibly becoming a thing of the past. One could say has become a thing of the past, and the shaping of the new world order is become the scene of uncompromising fight. Uncompromising, first and foremost, for the reason that it's not even the battle for power or geopolitical influence. It's a clash of the very principles that would be the foundation between the relation, for the relation of the countries at the next historical stage. And its outcome will define whether all of us jointly can build a world that would allow everyone to develop and to solve the outstanding contradictions based on mutual respect of cultures and civilization without coercion and use of force. In the end, can the human society remain a society with its ethical and humanistic principles? Will a human remain a human? It seems that there is no alternative to it, but just at the first glance. Unfortunately, there is an alternative to this. That is the descent of humankind into the abyss of aggressive anarchy, internal and external schisms, loss of traditional values, new forms of tyranny, essential abandonment of classic principles of democracy, basic rights and freedoms. More and more often, democracy is interpreted as the rule not of majority but of minority. They even contrast the traditional democracy and rule of people with a certain abstract freedom, and for that sake, democratic procedures, elections, majority, and the freedom of speech and media objectivity can be sacrificed. The threat is the imposal and becoming of ideologies totalitarian in their essence a norm. And that's what we see in the Western liberalism that has degenerated into, I believe, in extreme intolerance and aggression towards any alternative, towards any sovereign and independent thought. And today, it justifies neo-Nazism, terrorism, racism, and even mass genocide of civilian population. In the end, that's international conflicts and clashes that might bring about mutual destruction, because the weapons capable of doing that already exists, and it's constantly being improved. It acquires new forms as the technologies develop, and the club of the countries that possess such weapons is becoming wider, and no one can guarantee that in case of avalanche-like increase in threats and final deterioration of legal and moral norms, it would not be used. I have already said that we've come to a dangerous line, and calls of of the West to deliver strategic defeat to Russia, a country with the largest arsenal of nuclear weapons, shows extreme adventurism of the Western politicians, at least some of them. such blind faith in their own impunity and exceptionalism might turn to a global tragedy. At the same time, the previous hegemons used to rule the world back from colonial times learn, and more often to their surprise, that no one is listening to them. The attempts to maintain the power slipping away through force only leads to overall instability and great attentions to casualties and destruction, but the result that they're trying to achieve, to maintain their absolute power, such attempts do not ensure success because the course of history cannot be stopped. Instead of becoming aware of futility of their strive, the objective nature of changes, some of the Western elites seems are prepared to do everything not to allow for emergence of new international system in line with the interests of the global of the world majority. The policy of the U.S. and their allies in the past years is more and more prominent through the principle, if I can't have it, no one will. If you're not with us, you're against us. Well, this formula is very dangerous because here and in many countries of the world, there is such a saying that you reap what you sow. The chaos and systemic crisis is already in full swing in those countries that are trying to conduct such a policy. The claims to being exceptional, to being liberal and globalist messiahs, to ideological and military and political monopoly are depleting those countries more and more that are trying to conduct this policy and pushing the world towards deterioration. It comes in direct contradiction with the true interests of the nations of the U.S. and European countries. I'm sure that sooner or later the West will understand that, because the foundation of its former great achievements was always the pragmatic and sober approach based on very harsh and at times cynical but rational evaluation of what's happening in their own capacities. And here I'd like to highlight once again, unlike our opponents, Russia does not perceive the Western civilization as an enemy. It does not raise the question, us or them, who's not with us, he's against us. We never say that. We don't want to pontificate to anyone. We don't want to impose our worldview on anyone. Our position is an open one, and it's the following. The West has accumulated, indeed, tremendous human, intellectual, cultural, and material resources, thanks to which it can successfully develop, remaining one of the crucial elements of the world system. But it is precisely one of, together with other actively developing countries and states and groups of countries, the notion of hegemony in the new international sphere is off the table. And when Washington and other Western capitals become aware of that and recognize this cold, hard fact, then the process of building of the global system in line with the challenges of the future will finally enter the phase of true constructive building. I hope to God that it will happen as soon as possible. It is in common interest. Also in the interest, and first and foremost, in the interest of the West. As of now, everyone who is interested in the creation of a just and viable world have to spend too much effort on overcoming the destructive actions of the waste of the West, clinging to their own monopoly. It's apparent that it's happening, and everyone can see that. In the West, in the East, in the South, and everywhere. They're trying to keep their power and monopoly. These are apparent things. These efforts could have been directed with much greater use and result to solving common problems that indeed concern everyone. Demographic problems, social inequality, climate change, food security, healthcare, new technologies. That's what we could think about it. What we all truly need to work on. Today, I will allow myself several philosophical asides, since this is a discussion club. Then I hope that we'll follow in the vein of the discussions that were happening here before. I have already said that the world is changing drastically and irreversibly. It is unlike the previous version of world order. Due to the combination of parallel coexistence of two seemingly mutually exclusive phenomena, a fast rapidly growing conflict potential and fragmentation of political, economic, and legal field on the one hand, and the maintaining close interconnectedness of the whole world space on the other hand. It can be perceived as counterintuitive because we're used to the fact that such trends usually follow one another and substitute one another. Century after century, the times of conflict and breaking off ties are replaced by more beneficial periods of cooperation. That is the dynamic of development of history. It seems that it doesn't work today. But let's start to maybe have a bit of a discussion about it. Most acute and principled, emotionally charged conflicts naturally significantly complicate the global development but do not put an end to it. Instead of chains of cooperation destroyed by political means and even military means, appear another, more complex, sometimes less linear, but they maintain economic and social ties. We have seen that in the previous years. Quite recently, the so-called collective West made an unprecedented attempt to banish Russia from the global system of economic and political system. The number of sanctions and punitive measures against our country is unprecedented in history. Our opponents assume that they would deliver to Russia a devastating blow and knockout. Something that it would not bounce back from. It would stop being one of key elements of international system. I think there is no need to remind you of what happened in reality. The very fact that the anniversary edition of Valdai Club has gathered such a representative audience speaks for itself. Well, it's not a matter about Valdai. It's about the reality that we're living in right now, and in which the conditions which Russia lives in, and the world needs Russia, and no decisions by Washington or Brussels, alleged masters, cannot change it. The same applies to their other decisions. Even a well-trained swimmer cannot swim across to strong currents, regardless of tricks and doping that it uses. As for the global policy and the current it is taking, it's contrary to the strives of the West, from the outgoing hegemonic world to the upcoming diversity. This is an apparent thing. As we say, well, it doesn't take a smart man to say it. Let's go back to the dialectics of history and change of era of conflict and cooperation. Is indeed the world such that this theory it does not work in practice? Let's take a look at what's happening today at a different angle. What is the essence of the conflict and who's taking part in it? Since the mid-past century, when through joint effort and a tremendous price, it was possible to overcome Nazis and the most nefarious and aggressive ideology that was the fruit of most acute contradictions of the first half of the 20th century. The humanity was faced with a task to avoid the repetition of such phenomenon and the world wars. Despite all zigzags and local skirmishes, the overall direction was defined back then. That is, the radical rejection of all forms of racism, dismantling of the classical colonial system, and expansion of the number of fully-fledged members of international politics. The demand for openness and democratization of the international system, it was apparent. The fast development of different countries and regions, emergence of new technological and socioeconomic approaches aimed at expansion of capacity for development and improved life standards. Naturally, just like any historic process, that led to emergence of a clash of interest, but overall strive towards harmonization of development of all aspects of this phenomenon was readily apparent. Our country, back in the day it was the Soviet Union, made a tremendous contribution to the strengthening of this trend. The USSR was helping the states liberated from colonial or neocolonial dependence, be that Africa, Southeast Asia, Middle East, or Latin America. And I'd like to remind you separately that it was the Soviet Union that in the mid-80s of the past century advocated for the end of ideological confrontation and overcoming the heritage of the Cold War, the end of the Cold War per se, and later overcoming its heritage of those barriers that stood in the way of the unity of the world and its comprehensive development. Yes, we have a complex attitude to that period, considering what it has come to, you know, I mean, the policy of the then political leadership of the country. We still have to manage some of the tragic consequences of those times, but the very sentiment, I'd like to highlight the sentiment, though possibly too idealistic, coming from our leadership and our nation, at times naive, as we can see today, without doubt was dictated by the genuine desire for peace and comprehensive benefit. That is historically typical for the nature of our nation and its traditions and systems of spiritual and moral values. Why did such commitments lead to an opposite result? That's the question. Well, we know the answer. I've mentioned it many times before, this way or another, because the other side of ideological standoff perceived what was happening in history not as a chance to rebuild the world with a new just basis and principles, but as their own triumph, as a surrender of our country to the West. And that means they perceived it as an opportunity to use the right of the victor and to establish their complete domination. I spoke about it at times, but I will just give you an aside without giving the names. But at the end of the 90s, one of the political figures of the U.S. said back at the time, now we'll treat Russia not as a defeated opponent, but as a blunt instrument in our hands. That was their idea, their notion. They didn't have the width of vision or overall manners. They didn't understand what was happening. They didn't understand Russia. The way the West falsely and to their own benefit interpreted what it believed to be the outcome of the Cold War, the way it started to retailor the world for itself, its brazen and unchecked geopolitical greed, these are the true reasons for conflicts of our historical era, starting with the tragedy of Yugoslavia, Iraq, Libya, today of Ukraine and the Middle East. Some of the Western elites believed that the monopoly that emerged, their monopoly, the moment of unipolarity in ideological, economic, political, and even, to a certain extent, military and strategic sense, is the actual point of destination, the end of it. Stop for a moment, and it is beautiful. As they conceitedly said back then, it was the end of history. It is unnecessary to explain in this audience how myopic and false this notion was. The history did not come to an end. On the contrary, it entered a new phase. It's not about the fact that some nefarious enemies, competitors, saboteurs stood in the way of the West in establishing their system of global power. Let's speak frankly. After the USSR disappeared and the model of Soviet socialist alternative disappeared as well, many in the world first believed that the monopoly system is here to stay almost forever. And they just need to adjust to it. But it started to crumble on its own under the weight of ambition and avarice of the Western elite. And when they saw that even within that system that they have tailored to their own needs after the Second World War, naturally, we have to admit it, the victors created the Yalta system for their own needs. And after the Cold War, the alleged victors in the Cold War started to tailor the world for themselves, adjusting the Yalta system. That's the issue. The system that they created by their own hand is now successfully being used by others. There are now new leaders within that system. Naturally, they started to correct and tweak the system that they have created for their own good, and they started to violate the very rules that they spoke about yesterday. They started to change the rules set by themselves. So what kind of conflict do we see today? I am convinced that it's not the conflict of everyone against everyone caused by the violation of certain rules that we have been quite often told about from the West. Not at all. We see the conflict between the overwhelming population of the planet that wants to live and develop in an interconnected world of tremendous number of opportunities and the global minority, concerned by one thing, as I already said, maintaining their domination. And to that end, it's prepared to destroy the achievements that became the result of long-term development towards a comprehensive global system. But nothing will come of it, as we can see. Nothing doing. At the same time, the West itself is hypocritically trying to convince all of us that what's at stake is everything that humanity achieved after the Second World War. Nothing of the sort. I've just said it. Both Russia and an overwhelming majority of the countries are indeed trying to strengthen the spirit of international progress and strive towards sustainable peace that was the core of development since mid-past century. At stake is the very different thing, the monopoly of the West that emerged after the dismantling of the Soviet Union that was acquired for a time during the end of the 20th century. Yet again, I like to highlight, and everyone present here understand that any monopoly, as we know from history, comes to an end sooner or later. There could be no illusions here. A monopoly is a bad thing, even for the monopolists themselves. The policy of the elites of the collective West, of a powerful but rather a limited club, as for the number of participants, is not looking forward, not aimed towards constructive building, but it's looking backwards, trying to maintain advantage. Any sports fan, not even talking about professionals in sports, in hockey, in all types of martial arts, they know that trying to simply maintain the advantage is always a losing game. Going back to the dialectics of history, we can say that parallel existence of conflict potential and the strive towards harmony is naturally unsustainable. The contradiction of the era sooner or later will come to a head through synthesis and a transition to a new quality. When we enter this new phase of development and building of new global architecture, it's important for all of us not to repeat the mistakes of the end of the past century. As I've said before, back then West tried to impose on everyone there, I think, a deeply amoral model of exiting the Cold War, wrought with new conflicts. The emerging multipolar world, there should be non-countries and nations that feel that they've lost. No one should feel discriminated against and humiliated. Only with that we can ensure a truly long-term conditions for comprehensive, just, and safe development. The strive towards cooperation and interaction is now, without doubt, gaining the upper hand, overcoming most acute situations. We can boldly say that it is indeed the international mainstream and the course of events. Naturally, being at ground zero of tectonic shifts caused by sea changes in the global system, it's hard to forecast the future. But as we know, the general direction of change, from hegemony to a complex world of multilateral cooperation, we can try to draw certain outlines of the future. Speaking at the Valdai Forum last year, I have spoken about six principles that we believe should be the foundation for relations at the new historical stage. The events and the time that has passed since then, I believe, only confirmed that the proposed notions were both justified and well-founded. I will try to build on them. Number one, openness towards cooperation is a crucial value for an overwhelming majority of countries and nations. Attempts to build artificial barriers are vicious not only through the fact that they stand in the way of normal and beneficial economic development for everyone. Disconnection of ties is especially dangerous during natural disasters and social and political shocks, which is unfortunately the way of life. The situations are unacceptable, like the situation that happened after the catastrophic earthquake in Asia Minor. For purely political reasons, aid was blocked towards the nation of Syria. Some of its regions were tremendously affected by the natural phenomenon. And such examples, when egotistical and myopic interests stand in the way of overall prosperity, are not unique. Barrier-free environment that I spoke about last year is key not only to economic prosperity, but also to satisfying acute humanitarian needs. And amid new challenges, and among them are the consequences of rapid growth of technologies, it's imperative that humanity pools their intellectual efforts together.
It's telling that today openness is currently mostly being opposed by those who just recently, yesterday, as it were, used to call themselves its greatest champions. Today, the very same forces and people are trying to instrumentalize restrictions to exert pressure on those who think differently. But this is not going to work due to the very same reason. An overwhelming world majority favors openness without any politicization. Second, we've always spoken about world diversity as a sine qua non to ensure its stability. It might seem like a paradox. For the more mixed the world is, the more complicated it is to build a single framework. And of course, universal norms should be of help. Could they help that? There's no denying it. It is a difficult task. But first, it shouldn't come to a point when a model of a single country or a relatively small part of humanity is taken as something universal and imposed on all the rest. Secondly, no conventional, albeit quite democratically developed code cannot be perceived and prescribed as a directive and irrefutable truth once and for all, because the international community is a living organism whose worth and uniqueness consist in its civilizational diversity, whereas the international law is an outcome of agreements among peoples rather than countries, because legal consciousness is an indispensable and unique part of each culture and each civilization. The crisis of the international law that has been spoken about, in a sense, is growing pains, because the fact that peoples and cultures that, due to different reasons in the past, used to be left in the political sidelines are currently in the ascendant, and it means that their unique perceptions and views and notions of right and justice and law are playing an increasingly significant role in the world. It might seem like there is a lack of coordination and dissonance, but this is just the formative stage, and I'm confident that the world can only be built on the principles of polyphony, with all the themes being woven together in harmony. If you will, we are moving to a polyphonic world rather than a polycentric world, a world in which all the voices have to be heard and, what's most important, listened to. And those who've grown accustomed to playing solo and who wants to continue doing that will have to get used to living in a new world, playing to a new score. I spoke about the international law after the Second World War. The international law is based upon the UN Charter, which was written after the Second World War, but the world is changing. New poles of growth are emerging. Powerful economies are growing, getting to the foreground. And of course, international law has to change, but it has to be very cautiously done. Third, we've spoken on multiple occasions that a new world can only develop successfully based on the principle of representation, maximum representation, and the last two decades have clearly demonstrated the consequences of usurpation or attempts at appropriating the rights to speak and act on behalf of others. Those who are conventionally dubbed the great powers have grown accustomed to thinking that they have the right to determine the interests of others. Basically, growing used to dictating the national interests of other nations based on their own. This is an undermining of the principles of democracy and fairness, and what's worse, it prevents us from genuinely addressing urgent challenges. The incipient world is not going to be simple, owing primarily due to diversity. And the more fully-fledged, the greater the number of fully-fledged participants, the more difficult it's going to be to find the best option everyone is happy with. But once it's been found, it's going to make the world more sustainable and durable, and it'll help us get rid of petty tyranny and knee-jerk political zigzagging, and it'll also render political processes more thoughtful and rational based on the principle of reasonable sufficiency. And this principle is even applied within the UN Security Council, because the veto right was devised precisely to make sure that the decisions that the political stakeholders are not happy about do not pass. Is it good or is it bad? Probably not very good, but it creates certain barriers when decisions are to be made. But it's also very good because it prevents decisions from being passed if someone is not happy with them. So it means that you have to get back to the negotiating table and hammer out an agreement. But since the world is becoming multipolar, we have to come up with instruments that will help us expand the use of similar mechanisms. In each particular case, a solution has to be not just collective. It also has to involve the participants and the stakeholders that are capable of making a substantive and significant contribution to settling the problem. This involves primarily those who are interested in a positive outcome because their future security and hence prosperity depend on that. There are many, numerous examples of cases when complex, though solvable, disagreements between neighboring nations and peoples degenerated into intransigent chronic conflicts due to the scheming and brazen interference of external forces who basically do not care much about what's going to happen to the parties to the conflict, how much blood is going to be spilled, how many lives are going to be claimed. They are simply, those external forces are guided by their own selfish interests without assuming any responsibility. I also believe that regional organizations are going to play a very important role because however difficult the relations between neighboring countries, they are always brought together by a common interest in stability and security. Compromises are vital to achieve the best conditions for their own development. Next, a key principle is universal security for everyone without exception, because the security of ones cannot be assured at the expense of the security of others. I'm not saying anything new. It's all in the OSCE documents and it has to be observed. The block-based approach has been bequeathed to us from the colonial times and the Cold War, and it runs counter against the new international system, which is flexible and open. In the world today, only one bloc remains that is brought together by obedience and rigid ideological dogmas, and that is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And it continues its expansion to the east of Europe, all while trying to project its approaches to other spaces across the world, which is a violation of its founding documents. And this is a blatant anachronism. On many occasions, we've spoken about the destructive role that NATO continued to play, especially after the disintegration of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Treaty Organization, when seemingly the alliance had lost its formal raison d'etre, which had been declared before. I believe the U.S. understood that this tool was losing its attractiveness, as it were, but they still needed it, and they still need that to govern and to manage its zone of influence. So they need conflicts. You know, before all the acute crises of today, many European leaders were telling me, why are they using you to threat us? You know, I'm basically quoting them. And I think the U.S. understood that full well. They felt that. They saw NATO as a second-rate organization, but trust me, I know what I'm saying. But the experts over there understood the need for NATO. How do you keep it attractive? You have to scare them good. You have to sow discord between Europe and Russia, especially between Russia and Germany and France, and hence the coup d'etat in Ukraine and the hostilities in the east in Donbass. They basically force us to take actions in response, though they got what they wanted. And the same is happening in Asia, on the Korean Peninsula, I suppose. In practice, we see that the world minority is trying to preserve and reinforce its military bloc, thereby trying to preserve its power. But even within this bloc itself, there is a noticeable understanding that the strict diktat of the Big Brother in no ways does nothing to facilitate addressing the tasks at hand. And it also is in stark contrast to the aspirations of other countries of the world, because cooperating when it's beneficial, building partnership with anyone who is interested, that is the evident priority of most countries on our planet. It's evident that military, political, and ideological blocks are yet another type of hurdles built in the way of the natural development of the nascent international system. I would also like to point out that the very notion of a zero-sum game, when only one party stands to win, whereas everyone else stands to lose, has been born out of the Western political thought, and under the Western dominance, this approach was imposed on everyone under the pretext of its universality. But under no circumstances is that the case. Quite the contrary, the Eastern philosophy, many of you who have gathered here know that, and probably know that firsthand even better than I do, is based on another approach. And this approach is searching for a harmony of interest when everyone wants to achieve what's most important to them, but not to the detriment of the other party. I win, but you stand to win as well. And Russians, we as well in Russia, all the peoples of Russia, historically, when that was possible, assumed that it's not the most important thing, you know, trying to push through your opinion by any means possible. Rather, they were trying to convince and get them interested in a fair partnership and equal cooperation, whereas our history and the history of our diplomacy have demonstrated on many occasions the worth of honor, nobility, peace building, and generosity. Suffice it to remember Russia's role in rearranging the European order after the Napoleonic Wars. In many views, it's seen as trying to keep monarchies in power, but I'm not talking about the specifics, I'm talking about the general trends. And the prototype of a new free, non-block, block-free type of cooperation between nations and peoples, that is precisely the association built within BRICS. And this is amply demonstrated by the fact that even within NATO there are those who show interest in working closely with BRICS, and I do not rule out that in the future other countries will also think about cooperating more closely with BRICS. And this year our country held chairmanship in BRICS, and as you're aware, we've just recently held the summit in Kazan. I won't hide it, coming up with a coordinated approach among the countries whose interest diverge on many points is a tall order. Diplomats and other statespeople had to spare no effort and show a lot of tact, demonstrate the capacity to listen to one another to obtain the requisite result. It took a lot, but this is how we forge the unique spirit of cooperation, which is based on mutual understanding rather than coercion. And we are confident that BRICS sets a very good example for everyone as a beacon of constructive cooperation in a new international landscape. I would also like to add that within BRICS there are meetings of entrepreneurs, scholars, intellectuals of our countries. This can serve as a platform for a profound philosophical fundamental perception and analysis of the current processes of the world developing, with due regard for the characteristics of each and every civilization with their culture, history, identity, and tradition. The spirit of respect and due regard for the interests of one another. This is precisely the basis of the future system of Eurasian security, which is beginning to take shape across our vast continent. And this is not just about a multilateral approach. This is also a multifaceted process, because right now security is a comprehensive notion that encompasses not just the military and political aspect. It's impossible to achieve without ensuring social and economic development of any nations, and also stability against any external challenges, both natural and man-made, in the real world and in cyberspace. Fifth, fairness for everyone, because inequality is the true scourge of the modern world. Within nations, inequality breeds social tensions as well as political instability, whereas in the international arena, it is a source of the development gap between the golden billion and the rest of humanity, which is fraught with greater political disagreements and also most importantly with worsening migration issues. Almost all developed nations of the planet are facing increasingly less controllable influx of those who want to improve their material circumstances, say, obtain a high social status, gain better prospects, and sometimes simply to survive. And this migration wave sometimes leads to a surge in xenophobia, intolerance to foreigners, and richer societies, which sets off the spiral of social and political troubles and increase a greater level of aggression. The fact that some countries are lagging behind in terms of social and economic development is a comprehensive phenomenon, and there is no magic wand to conjure this disease away. We need to work in a systemic fashion and long term. We need to create conditions which will remove artificial politically motivated barriers in the way of development. We have to remove attempts at instrumentalizing the economy, at weaponizing it, because whoever is the target, everyone gets hit. And the heaviest blow is against the most vulnerable, the people and countries that need support. We are confident that such issues as food security, energy security, access to health care and education, and finally, orderly and free movement of people have to be secured against being held hostage to conflicts and controversies, because these are basic human rights. Sixth, we highlight indefatigably that any sustainable international order can only be based upon the principle of sovereign equality. It's true that each nation has different potential. It's evident, and their capacities are vastly different. That often gives rise to the notion that full equality is impossible, it's a utopia, it's illusory, but the characteristic of the modern world, which is so integrated and well connected, is that countries that are not the most powerful or the biggest one sometimes can punch far above their weight, at least due to the fact that they are capable of being more rational and targeted in the use of their human intellectual, natural and environmental potential. They're agile and flexible in addressing complex tasks. They set the bar high in quality of life, in ethics, governance efficiency, in building the opportunity for self-fulfillment of each and every person, in building a very favorable psychological atmosphere in society, which is favorable to the development of science, entrepreneurship, arts, creativity, tapping the talents of young people. These translate into the factors of global influence. To paraphrase the laws of physics, maybe the force is not that great, but its efficiency is far better. But the most destructive thing today is arrogance and high-handedness, as well as the need to constantly and ceaselessly pontificate. Russia has never been the one to do that. And we see that our approach is productive. Our historic experience shows indisputably that inequality, be that within society, within the state, or in the international arena, will inevitably lead to nefarious consequences. And I would like to add something that I haven't spoken about over the many centuries of the Western-centric world. We've seen the emergence of certain cliches and stereotypes, sort of in hierarchy. Allegedly, there is the developed world, progressive humanity, a certain universal civilization that everyone is supposed to aspire to, whereas there are also backward, uncivilized peoples, basically barbarians, and their only mission is to listen unquestioningly to what they're being told and to act at the behest of those who allegedly stand higher than they do on this civilizational ladder. Obviously, this is a cover for a brazen colonial approach aimed at exploiting the world majority. But the thing is, this is a basically racist ideology that has taken root in the consciousness of many people. And this is also a very serious mental hurdle in the way of universal harmonious development. The world today abhors haughtiness, but it doesn't tolerate deafness towards the uniqueness of others. In order to build normal relations, you've got to listen to your interlocutor. You have to understand their logic and cultural background rather than trying to project on them what you think about them, your own notions. Otherwise, your communication is going to be a dialogue of the deaf, labeling and also exchange of stereotypes. You know, know about unique cultures of different nations. On the surface, everything looks decent, you know, music, the folklore. They've been elevated, but essentially, the economic and security policy remains the same. Neo-colonial, in its essence, just look at how it works, because the Western economies are blocking everything, trying to pursue their own interests. I refer to the WTO example. They're trying to preserve their dominance for decades and centuries. We have to remember that everyone is equal in that everyone is entitled to their vision. No better or no worse than other visions. It's just theirs. And this is the basis for mutual understanding of our interests, as well as respect, empathy, ability to commiserate, to listen to the arguments and points of views of others, and not just to listen, but also to build your policies based on that. Because listening to others does not imply simply agreeing with everything and accepting everything. This is about recognizing the right of your interlocutor to have their own worldview. This is basically the first step in the quest for a harmony in your worldviews, because we have to learn to see diversity and differences as something precious and a source of opportunities rather than conflicts. And this is also about the dialectics of history. We understand, you and I, that the era of drastic transformations will lead to inevitable clashes of interests and shocks. Everyone is going to get to readjust to one another, and probably this interconnectedness of the world, rather than assuage differences, will exacerbate them, making them more jumbled, and the quest for a solution more difficult. Because over the many centuries of its history, humanity has grown accustomed to viewing the use of force as the last resort for resolving differences. Whoever is more powerful is right. Yes, sometimes this principle does work, and it does happen, and a lot. Countries are forced to fend for their interests with up in arms, using all means at their disposal. But the world of today is becoming increasingly complex, and sometimes using force to address one problem will breed another problem, and other problems which are going to be even more grave. And we understand that our country has never been the one to initiate the use of force. We only are forced to do that when it becomes clear that our opponent is acting aggressively and is not willing to listen to any type of argument. And whenever necessary, we will take any measure we need to and have to do to protect Russia and our citizens, and we will always achieve our goals. The world is absolutely non-linear and inherently heterogeneous. We've always understood that. You know, I was not going to take the trip down memory lane, but I remember very well back in 1999 when I stood at the helm of the government and then I went on to become the head of state. You know, there was something we were facing back then. I think the Russian citizens and the experts who are present here remember that very well as well. We remember the forces behind the terrorists in the Northern Caucasus. We know where from and in what size they were getting money and weapons, moral, political, and ideological support. You know, sometimes it's laughable, but also very sad to remember those developments, because, you know, Al-Qaeda, it's bad, but when it's fighting against you, then it's all right. And all of that breeds conflict. Back then, we fixed a goal for ourselves to use all the time we have to spare no effort to preserve our country. And it served the interests of all the peoples of Russia, despite the dire economic straits after the 1998 crisis and the armed forces falling into disrepair. We've managed to rise together and repel the attack of the terrorists and went on to rout them. Why did I choose to remind you of that? Because right now there are those who once again come up with the notion that the world without Russia is going to be better off, and they wanted to destroy what was left after the disintegration of the Soviet Union, and right now there are those who think that the world is going to be more obedient, is going to be easier to control without Russia. But on multiple occasions, Russia stopped those who sought world domination, whoever that was. And we're going to do that. And the world is not going to be better. And those who do not understand that, they have to realize that it's only be more difficult. And our opponents are still coming up with new instruments to get rid of us. Right now, they're trying to instrumentalize Ukraine and Ukrainians as such a tool. They are cynically training Ukrainians against Russians, basically turning Ukrainians into cannon fodder. And all of that is accompanied by conversations about a European choice. What kind of choice is that? We don't need that, for sure. We will protect ourselves and our citizens. Let no one labor under any illusion to that end. But of course, this is not the end of Russia's world role, dramatic as it may sound, but Russia's very existence is the guarantee that the world is going to preserve its diverse color, stability, and complexity. This is also a safeguard of successful development, and this is not me who is saying that, because our friends from across the world are telling me that. I'm simply repeating them. I would like to reiterate that we're not trying to impose anything on anyone. We're not going to do that. We don't need that. We are guided by our values, interests, and notions of what is right that have deep roots in our identity, history, and culture. And we're certainly always open to a constructive dialogue with everyone, because whoever has respect for their own culture and tradition will certainly have the same type of respect for other cultures and traditions. Whereas those who are trying to make others behave in an improper manner will inevitably trample their own roots, their civilization and culture. And to a certain extent, this is what we're witnessing today. Today, Russia is fighting for its freedom, for its sovereignty and rights. Without exaggeration, I'm saying that because during the previous decades, on the surface, everything looked so decent because, you know, G7 was turned into G8. Thank you. We were invited. But you know what was truly happening? Because I saw that firsthand. See, you come to the G8 and it becomes clear from the outset that before the G8, the G7 had a separate meeting and they had some separate conversations and they had discussed Russia, and then they invite Russia to talk with them. You look at all of this with a smile. That is how I looked at it. But in practice, you know, it is a great picture, a great image, the hugs and, you know, patting on the shoulder. But in practice, they are continuing to move forward on the offensive. You know, the most flagrant example is the expansion of NATO to the east. They had promised they were not going to do that, but it was happening, and the same was happening in the Caucasus, and also it was happening with regard to the ABM system. So on any key issue, they didn't care one bit about our opinion. We saw this creeping intervention, which, without any exaggeration, was aimed at demeaning our country and, at best, at destroying our country from within and from outside. You see what they did to Ukraine. They intervened basically with their bases in 2008. The Bucharest decision was made to open the doors to Georgia and Ukraine. Where did that come from? Had there been any difficulties in the world affairs? Yes, we did had some disputes with Ukraine with regard to the gas prices, but we did manage to arrive at a solution. Why did they need to create conditions for a conflict? Because it was crystal clear what the consequences were going to be. But they didn't stop at that. They were trying to project their influence across our historic territories, they were supporting the regime which had clear pro-fascist tendencies. So it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that and to repeat that. We are not simply fighting for our own freedom and our sovereignty and our rights. We are also fighting for universal rights and freedoms. We are fighting for the chance for every country to develop on the basis of sovereign equality. And this is the mission of our country. And everyone needs to understand there's no use trying to exert pressure on us. But as for coming to an agreement with due regard for the mutual legitimate interests of one another, this is something we've always been ready for, and this is what we've been asking all participants of the international community to do. And if that happens, then the future participants of the Valdai Club, which are still school children, students, PhD candidates, young scholars and novice experts, and 20 years or so on the eve of the centenary of the UN, we'll probably talk about something more optimistic and life reassuring than the subjects and we have to broach today. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, for such an extensive and voluminous depiction of the world and of Russian views on it. Naturally, we are very happy to say that last time you presented your main principles here as well, and today you've built on them. I think it's becoming some kind of a doctrine. Valdai does not lay claim to being called in the name of the doctrine, but we're happy that it's been born here. Mr. President, many topics that you've touched upon were discussed here at the 21st session. I wanted to share with you, we would like, all of us would like to share with you some of conclusions that we reached, not all of the sessions because there were many of them, but some of them that we believe most crucial. These are topics that you've mentioned as well. I would like to give the floor first to our longtime participant, colleague, and a person well known to you, Ruslan Yunusov, who took part in the session about the artificial intelligence, forgive me, the most fashionable thing. Good evening, Mr. President. Indeed, we have discussed what you've touched upon in your today's speech, the topic of artificial intelligence. We had a separate session. It was called Artificial Intelligence, a revolution or a fad. But before I will highlight our conclusions, I'd like to say that two Nobel Prizes were given for the developments in the artificial intelligence sphere, physics and chemistry, simultaneously. It was unprecedented. Does it highlight that there is a revolution going on in artificial intelligence? Most likely it's a yes, because Nobel Committee quest often follows a fashion in their decisions. But moving on to the topics of our discussion here at the Valdai Club, I'd like to highlight several aspects that we have discussed. We've kicked it off with an issue that troubles many. Will the artificial intelligence substitute a human or not, especially in the spheres where one needs creativity, for example, science and art? What do we see in science today? Is indeed the artificial intelligence part of the process? Yes, many achievements have been reached due to artificial intelligence. Still, we see that there is no substitution of human in the scientific process. More likely, the progress is speeding up, but the well-qualified young people are much more needed than before, so we don't see a risk there. We have also discussed economics through the prism of artificial intelligence. During the COVID times in the 2020, we believe that the exit out of the global recessions will be done mainly through the such driver as artificial intelligence. Did the forecast come to life? Yes, indeed, AI is being introduced in many sectors of economy. But if we take a look at the figures, we will see that those very optimistic expectations did not come true. It was more of a more conservative scenario. Moreover, the expectations continue today, and we see there are certain investment bubbles, and that might portend future negative trends. Though the technology of artificial intelligence itself seems that will develop further and will become a the basis for economy. We've also discussed security. Today, we have to say that terrorist organizations are using the AI during recruitment of new members or in wider propaganda sense. Fake news videos are today a standard tool for such groups. On the other hand, AI is used as well as to counter extremism and terrorism. The AI might find such extremist elements in society. And those who have doubts, for example, may be also convinced by AI, so they don't radicalize themselves. When we were looking at the balance, are there more pluses than minuses? It seems that there are more positive things in terms of security and AI, and we hope that this balance will be leaning towards the positive. Naturally, here at the Baldai, we can't help but discuss the political aspects of AI. And we saw some research where the researchers used the main generative models of AI, and they used it for testing for political views. And it seems that AI is not neutral politically. It's not politically neutral. It has tremendous bias towards left liberalism. It has largely to do with the views of their creators. And in the past few years, we see that the learning of AI is being done through synthetic data rather than real-life data. And that also makes the views of such models more radical. In the coming next years, we'll receive the first university alumni that have used AI during their studies. Before, we're looking at different theses, and the students were looking at primary sources, they analyzed them and presented it. Now you can use the AI for it. It is clear that the quality of learning is decreasing, but much more nefarious is this an indirect impact of AI, which shapes their worldview and incepts them with ideology, which is not being shaped in Russia from over the ocean and abroad. As a conclusion, we see that we need to strengthen control and regulation of the AI. At the same time, if we follow the prohibitive measures, I don't think that will give the necessary result. We'd rather need to support the domestic technologies of AI. Good thing that we have tremendous achievements in there, and we need to motivate this progress further. I think that will be the basis for technological sovereignty in this sphere. We'd like to highlight that Russia is one of three countries in the world which have the full stack of IT technologies. Indeed, that is the basis for sovereignty. And as a wrap-up for my presentation, I can say that our foreign guests noted that some countries already have limitations in place or even full bans on the use of AI. For us, for Russia, it's more of an opportunity. We can prove ourselves as a technological leader and export such technologies of the artificial intelligence to our partner countries. Thank you so much.
If
you allow, I'll give my two cents in return. First and foremost, indeed, the AI is one of the crucial tools for development. One of our priorities, first and foremost in economy, but in other spheres as well, in the use of big data. Indeed, that is the development of the artificial intelligence. Considering that we have a great deficit of labor force, 2.4% is our unemployment rate. That means it's basically a deficit of labor, and we see that such issues in the economic sphere can be done through the development of breakthrough technologies. For example, the use of artificial intelligence, one of the mainstream dimensions here. Are there more positive things or negative things? What about nuclear energy? Is it more beneficial or not? The use of peace atom in agriculture, in healthcare, in transportation. It plays a tremendous role, and it would only increase, I'm sure of it, especially considering the climate change and the issues presented by it. Still, we have nuclear weapons. On the other hand, it creates great risks for humanity. The same applies to the artificial intelligence. It's a matter of regulation and the way that people use it. As for regulation, yes, many countries have the regulation. And some even have bans in place. I think it's impossible to ban it. It will still find its way through, especially in the conditions of competition, an ever-increasing one. I'm not talking about the armed confrontation, but indeed there is greater competition in economy. Amid competition, it's unavoidable that the artificial intelligence would be developing. And here we could be one of the leaders. I mean certain advantages that we have in place. As for sovereignty, a crucial element. Yes, these platforms are usually trained abroad. And they shape the worldview. Indeed, it is so. And we have to be aware of it. And we need to develop our own sovereign artificial intelligence. We need to make use of everything that's out there. But we need to develop our own competitions. We have Sberbank and Yandex that are working actively on it, and they're quite successful. Naturally, we'll do all of it, without doubt. Especially when the AI reproduces itself. It's very interesting and very promising. There are certain threats as well. We need to see them, to be fully aware of them, and to build our work accordingly. But as I have said, this is one of the most crucial directions of our joint work. When I say our work, I mean both the specialists in this sphere and the state and the whole society. Because there are a lot of moral questions here. We need to pay attention to it. You've also mentioned radical views that are being shaped by the AI. Yes, we need to counter that timely with our own view and point of view to all processes that are taking place in our society and the world. That's what we'll do together. Thank you so much for pointing that out. Thank you so much. We'll continue to analyze what's happening. Yes, you must. Indeed, the AI in Russia should be taught by Russian data to reflect our culture. Absolutely so. And we have such an opportunity. Absolutely, it's apparent. I'm sure that we will succeed and it will bear fruit for us. It will be great support in our development. And it will be a great advantage. Thank you. Mr. President, what about sovereign artificial intelligence? When we have it, will be able to present us with a Russian idea for the 21st century? It can only help us solve the issues that we are faced with. It's very important the way we formulate them. Since it operates with big data, well, we have every opportunity, both intellectual and technological. We have a great number of free energy. There is a lot of space for us to work here, and I think that such matters as you have just raised, philosophical matters, fundamental matters, we need to engage all tools, and it's up to us whether to believe it or not when we receive the result of the quest that we have received with the use of artificial intelligence as well. Thank you. An adjacent topic that we've discussed, where artificial intelligence comes together with information, then there's a lot of happening there, both advantages and disadvantages everywhere. Our Indian colleague, Arvind Gupta, took part in that session. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Arvind Gupta, Mr. President, and I come from India. I work on the intersection of technology and society and building a digital public infrastructure for population scale problems. Thank you, Mr. President. You have already addressed some of the issues that my colleague Ruslan here talked about on AI, but I thank you for listening to our summary, and our expert panels discuss the issue of something which is adjacent to AI, and I will in the end mention that, of information manipulation, surveillance using technology and data, and the lack of transparency in all technology systems today. Mr. President, you know, the group discussed that the internet was designed about 40, 45 years ago to be a global public good. Unfortunately now, like many other things, it's become very unipolar. It's controlled by a few big tech firms with their own ideological leanings. Some of these platforms or big tech firms are not allowed to operate in countries like India, Russia, Indonesia, and many others for their roles in manipulation and surveillance. The second issue we discussed, Mr. President, was the algorithms that, that we discussed previously in the AI session also, really define how we think. The AI is actually becoming a new buzzword today, but the algorithms have been around for a long time, and they really define how we think, how we consume, how we elect our governments. As all of us have agreed, they have a leaning towards an ideology and definitely are not neutral. So the algorithms themselves are biased. The other thing the group discussed was the whole weaponization of information and data. And that, coupled with the biased technology platforms, are giving certain nation states massive power. And it's influencing national security, democracy, and the public order in general. So, Mr. President, you are aware that this has been the form of Western technology platforms. But India presented an alternate model during its G20 presidency to this Western technology platforms. It's a platform which takes society into account. It's a bottom-up platform built around identity, a universal identity system, a universal payment system. It's actually used by more than a billion people and in India, and more than 20 other countries use it. This is to present that how India has created a different vision for technology from the Western vision that exists today. Mr. President, I must commend Russia for succeeding, making the Mir platform very successful in Russia in a very, very strong time. And that also shows the power of technological sovereignty that was just mentioned, that it can be done if the desire is there. Mr. President, the issue that you just discussed, I progress with this biasness of technology and technology platforms and the non-neutral nature with what is coming head-on to us, the artificial intelligence era. Given that we let a few big companies control the internet, how do we ensure that that our culture, our society, our national interests are going to be protected in this whole era of artificial intelligence? What kind of guardrails do we need to build from the start to have fair and responsible AI? How do we ensure that that like-minded states work together for non-weaponization of AI, for non-weaponization of artificial intelligence? And lastly, Mr. President, we would like to hear from you. How do we build trust in the information that we see in news and technology at large?
This is a very important subject, and it's related to the previous issue, AI, its development and use, and there are several aspects to this matter. To start with, the use of the internet should certainly be founded upon sovereign algorithms. This is something we have to aspire to. Secondly, on the part of the government, it is very difficult. It's possible, but it's going to be counterproductive if we try to prohibit everything, you know, if the government chooses this path. In Russia, the professional community has arrived at an understanding on the rules for doing the business in the internet. And this professional community has assumed several independently developed self-restrictions, trying to prevent any destructive influence upon society, especially on young audiences. And I think this kind of self-regulation is one of the views. It's one of the ways to ensure the interests of the majority. But of course, the internet has to comply with domestic legislation of the country it's been operated in. It's evident. That said, we are witnessing manipulation of information. Unfortunately, this does happen. But I would like to reiterate, if the internet complies with domestic legislation, and it should be the case, then this will allow us to minimize potential negative consequences. I do understand the technological difficulties and restrictions. It's going to be a tall order, but if we choose this path of engaging with the professional community that sees where the threats might be coming from for society, then it's gonna be a way for the professional community to address those threats on its own. But of course, the government should be willing to lend a helping hand. For such countries as Russia and India, this is a task that can be addressed. We have very good, top-notch specialists and experts. We've got very good schools of mathematics. We've got people who have proven to be leaders in this field. Well, even if their companies are not yet leaders, they themselves, as experts, have raised to prominence in the field. So we've got everything we need, especially in such countries as India and Russia. Now, as for the Mir payment system that you have mentioned, to an extent, it's been a success, it's working, it's functioning, it could function even better, and it could be expanded if there had been no artificial barriers put in the way. But even though these barriers are being built, Mir payment system is developing, and we're going to replicate this success. The issue of the internet, you know, it has become a permanent fixture of our discussions. You said that the internet was created as a public good to serve the benefit of humanity. Well, of course, it was built for other purposes in the very beginning, but at a certain point in time, its goals changed. And if we've got to make sure that our activities in the internet, just as any other type of human activity, should be in compliance with moral and legal requirements. Of course, technologically, it's not always easily achievable, but it can be done. Society has to protect itself against destructive influence. But at the same time, we've got to ensure free exchange of information, and we also have to make sure that it benefits the development of countries and the international community at large. And we in Russia are going to pursue this path. I know India follows suit, and we're going to work together on this subject. And thank you for paying so much attention to this issue. But of course, it's impossible to overlook this matter or not to work on that. So I wish you every success. Mr. President, do you use the internet yourself? Well, you know, I'm a very novice user. I can press some buttons to look something up. So you do happen to do that? Our systems, yes, your systems. Very good, thank you. That is a consolation. We have spoken in detail about the environment, the state of world affairs in terms of climate, and this so on and so forth. I would like to give the floor to a good friend of ours, Mr. Rasidan Makaraj from South Africa. He's going to speak on the subject.
Mr. President, also for updating us that the dialectic of history continues itself. Yeah. Yeah, environmental problems, as you mentioned as well, cannot be solved separately.